Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science girl, on this Tuesday, February 16th. And today we're going to learn about a new and exciting opportunity growing in popularity, artist residencies at sea. We will talk to four different artists about their experience working out at sea on marine science vessels and the art forms that they explore. With us today are artists David Fries and Leslie Reed from the University of South Florida, Michelle Schwengel-Regala, and Rebecca Rutstein. First, let's talk with our University of South Florida participants, Dr. David Fries and Leslie Reed. David is a practicing scientist at the Institute for Human-Machine Cognition and in the Environmental Sciences Department at the University of South Florida. And Leslie is a graduate student in the Arts Department at University of South Florida. And I believe we have Leslie with us. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carly. Thank you for having me.
So, Leslie, I'm really excited that you were able to call in today. Thank you so much. Can you tell us a little bit about your artist residency experience and what you have done in the last couple months?
Sure. I was brought on along with David Fries as part of a project working with pH on board the Falkor and studying ocean acidification. I made work involving photography. I'm a graduate student here at USF, and I was greatly honored to be the artist at sea, the first one. So I basically soaked the film that I was working with in seawater to express the unseen forces of the oceans upon that film, and using the chemistry to actually etch into the film. So it was an incredible experience, and being on the Falkor was just amazing. I highly recommend it to any interested artist.
Excellent. And I want to dive more into the experience and how this all came to be. I believe we also have David on the phone. David, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome to the show, David.
Wonderful to be here.
So, now, David, this artist residency combination with yourself and Leslie and Schmidt Ocean Institute and Falkor all came about probably about 6 months ago. And tell me a little bit more about how you got involved with this project and how seawater and pH all comes together for you.
Yeah, it's kind of a torturous odyssey, if you would, you know, sailing through the oceans of experience. I have always been, so this goes back a little bit into kind of this interest in art. I've always been interested in the mystery of things and understanding the underlying nature of reality. And hence, we typically call that science and query. But also, from a perspective standpoint, artists do the same thing. In other words, there's a common movement between artists and scientists in that they want to understand the nature of things, or they're inquiring into that in different pathways, but still the same interest to try to look at the nature of things. So I've always, you know, just been interested where, science can inform art, but art can also inform science. And that, to me, is a very interesting area. And if you want a good example of that, science is informing art, you can look at Salvador Dali. He had much of his inspiration and type of thinking he did in his works. In fact, you know, many of his works had the same kind of driving force, where he looked at the science in optics, relativity, and quantum physics to help inspire his art. So it's kind of an interesting example of that. But because of that, at the University of South Florida, I also had a presence that, in addition to the marine sciences, so thinking of things, all things oceans, I also would think about some art-related activity, primarily trying to see where to inject technology in. And so being in the arts department and the marine sciences simultaneously was an interesting nexus for thinking both, you know, marine science or ocean science but also thinking about art. And my interaction with Leslie, we interacted on some projects together, looking at interesting experimental photographic and or technological approaches of the fusion of two. And so from that, I had an opportunity interacting with the Smith Ocean Institute on some technical interaction. The knowledge of having an artist in residence essentially on board became a really fascinating opportunity. And the fact is, it was an inaugural one. I was really excited to be able to contribute to that, and then also to contribute kind of philosophically, expanding what we normally think as artists as strictly only being thinking about, what the senses can perceive and what the artist can think of, but then thinking, could we fuse in some science and or some technology into that art? And hence, Leslie and I got to talking, and we saw an opportunity to potentially, get on with the Ocean Institute, the Smith Ocean Institute. And during the time, we thought it was best that she, with her artistic eye, could record a lot of the, essentially the aesthetic part of the transect of the ship. And at the same time, then I could work in parallel on figure out ways to take what was being recorded or sensed or measured on the ship and make that into kind of a parallel art kind of piece. So
interesting.
From that, how we came together and how we came to be on board. So she came to be on board and I was working shoreside, but I was there in spirit.
This is a really interesting intersection between art and science, between imagery and technology, between, expression and science. There's all these really neat parallels here that transform through your work. Now, Leslie, was this your first time on a research vessel?
Yes, it was.
And so how was that experience for you, being on the ship? How did that influence your art that you were taking? And was there anything surprising about the experience?
Oh, there were a lot of surprises. There's nothing that can really prepare you for being out to sea for that long. I have a small boat called the Dripping Wet. It's just a little like a skiff. So I had been out on boats before, but never a ship of that scale. And it really is like a beehive. Everybody has a very specific role to play and a job to do. And it was incredible just to see everyone at work and to learn about ship life and things like celestial navigation were very inspiring. It's also inspiring just to see how the ocean changes on a daily basis. The waves are never the same, but it's all part of the same. The word I'm looking for, I wish I was a scientist. I would know the word, the same element, I suppose.
Well, I think that variety comes out in your work too, right? I mean, the pictures you were taking along the way were influenced by the seawater, and the seawater, looking at the pH changed throughout the journey, and that had to have some influence on you as well.
Absolutely, and it really did etch its way into the film, and it resembles brush strokes and color shifts, and while some of it you can predict, a lot of it is still mysterious, just like the ocean. And I love that, so much of it is unexplored and undiscovered, and that's why it's great to work with the Schmidt Ocean Institute on that kind of research, finding out, this undiscovered frontier.
And was there a particular message you were trying to send or create through the art that you did while on the ship?
Well, I hope it'll inspire people to learn more about the ocean and appreciate it. I didn't fully realize the impact that humans had upon the sea until being, out there and talking with scientists about some of the more problems that we cause, unfortunately, as people. And so finding those kinds of solutions and inspiring people to care about that and to perhaps make small changes in their daily lives that can, have a big impact when it's all taken together. So I hope my work can just sort of start that conversation. I'm not trying to convey one specific platitude or message with it. Mm-hmm. I think art is much more about experience and inspiring people to be curious and discover more about the world around them in general.
Well, I have to say, I learned a lot about you guys and your art from this project as well. Now, David, this plasm work that you were doing in conjunction with Leslie's photographs, tell us a little bit about this, because to me, this was a whole new area that I had not really thought about or even heard of before chatting with you.
Yes. So, you know, my science led me ultimately into kind of stumbling into this art space. In my past, I've done the Internet of Things on the water. I did it years ago, putting automated robots and drones underwater, so on and so forth. New sensors for being able to explore the ocean. And so one of the things that kind of emerged, I'm very interested in automated processes. And what that means kind of sounds very dry, but ways to basically automate things just to explore the difference between being human and being, you know, just something automatic. And as much as I developed the automatic part, I absolutely, much more in tune and connected to the human part as a result of doing that. So from that, some of the work I do in the science space, I became interested in automatic generative systems. And that what that means is basically creating structures of patterns automatically. Now, actually, one of the technologies I developed was a automatic patterning tool or technology that you can use in a lab to make everything from microcircuits to laboratories on a chip and so on and so forth. So I was very interested in this automatic kind of generative systems, and it turns on out there's an analog in the art space, again, going back to Salvador Dali, this surrealist actually played, you know, these games and these activities about automatically generating ideas. And so, I mean, this is, you know, this is close to 100 years ago. And so there are some parallels between the artists exploring automatic generative patterns and then also just technology being able to do that. And so from that, I had linked in with who's now a really good friend of mine, an artist out of the Netherlands. His name is Tez. And he's an audio and visual artist. Also does some musical score compositions with a fellow artist in a group called Clock DVA, which I'm really good, have a good, strong association with. But Tez had been working on essentially some generative programs for generating visual displays using these, what's known as Turing chemical reactions. So this is from the famous computer scientist Alan Turing, who is the basis for the movie The Imitation Game. And so the Tez had worked on what was called plasm, and plasm is basically this, you know, pattern generating visual display that uses the algorithms of Turing algorithms. And Tez had got that ultimately from a mathematician. So in a collaboration with a mathematician who provided some of those algorithms, then encoded that and then created the display. We got together and started working, you know, trying to advance it just as an exploratory kind of element, worked it into a performance at the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, because I thought it was apropos, because, again, the spirit between how the surrealist and the technology that's generating these art programs, have the interplay between the two. And so from that, one of the things I proposed and really was motivated, and Tez also got very excited about when I proposed it, was the opportunity of not using just algorithms and random number generators and kind of dry equations to be able to drive this. Just could we use sensor data that's measuring something from nature to help drive the pattern? And so in some ways, giving both the machine, let's call them, sensors as machines, and those machines embedded in nature, in this case the ocean, the ability of the environment to start interacting and automatically generate art.
And
so the plasm,
The sensors you used too were the Wendy Schmidt Ocean Health X Prize pH sensors, correct?
Correct. And so exactly, we got excited about pH in particular because pH is one of those kind of ubiquitous measurements and, you know, contributes to ocean acidification. And the opportunity, again, to specifically go, you know, interact with the Schmidt Ocean Institute on their that particular transect was of interest because there was that was one of the main themes in that transect, which is pH measurement and ocean acidification. So the opportunity to use pH data coming off a sensor that was novel on the boat, which I was aware of from my science base, made it even more doubly, you know, interesting. So then we can then incorporate that into kind of signals that go on and influence the generative patterns. And these are lovely generative patterns that pop on out. Some of them are, you know, they never repeat, but, you know, some of them are highly, you know, they pop out at you, but some of them look like almost tissue, like, you know, like bones and muscle and so on. It's very fascinating, but we call them biomorphic. But now what we're doing is linking in that data from the pH sensor into influencing how the patterns kind of work and working through that process. But yes, we were actually using, we started incorporating, we're fusing on in pH sensor data that was on the cruise. And it's just a good example of now, you know, it's an emerging example of nature doing generative art, and not just strictly algorithms and dry equations.
And it's so nice to see the different art forms coming together between the plasm as well as the pictures or the photographs that Leslie took. Now, Leslie, how are you going to interact or merge your art with the plasm? Is there any plans to show your art? And I know you're going to be using some of that art for your graduate project. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. It'll be featured in an exhibition at the Contemporary Art Museum here at USF, and that will be on April 1st. The plasm will not be featured in that exhibition because that is part of, you know, my work towards my MFA. However, at the Florida Aquarium, they will show together, and I think there's a lot of visual connectivity between the two as far as those organic shapes and marks. And also, you know, the source material of the pH affecting both projects. So I'm really excited to be able to collaborate with David and Tez. I met David through working with bioluminescence on film a while back, and we were both very interested in augmented reality experiences and ways to add layers of experience for the viewer when seeing the work. And there will also be the show, like I mentioned, at the Florida Aquarium. And then also there's plans for Mark's Garage as well.
Right here in Honolulu.
Yeah.
And David, what about you? What's next? So you have the data, you have the plasm. What do you envision or what would you like to see happen next with this art form?
Through kind of this data flow and fusing of the components. I mean, this is from a software and coding standpoint, you know, because we're taking kind of heterogeneous components and trying to make them all so it seamlessly works together. So that's part of what we're doing in linking the environmental process in the sensor and then the, you know, the pattern generation. As Leslie said, you know, the plan is to basically work with the Florida Aquarium and make this in Mark's Garage in Hawaii, and possibly at a later date also at the Contemporary Art Museum at USF, where they have both of these things running. But ultimately, we see this as those three venues are be good for us to be able to continually shape this fusion, because there's a lot going on, you know, through this work. I mean, there's, you know, different offshoots of innovation here. So I'm excited about what we're doing in terms of fundamentally almost creating kind of a science and art innovation to create patterns And then also just augmented, just as Leslie was talking about, kind of augmented layered imagery. There's some additional things we want to do. So it's a kind of an ongoing process. So short answer is similar. We've got a couple of shows or venues we want to try to fuse the two. But it's all about essentially imagery, dynamic imagery in one case, then the recorded, you know, imagery that she was able to do, but then also layering on information to make, you know, her objects even dynamic. So there's an interactive piece with a technological kind of phone application. So there's a couple other pieces. That's where I'd like it to go. So it's got what I call the the 2.0 or virtual reality, if you would, or not I don't call it virtual, but basically computer reality. The 1.0 of her world, which is the physical objects that she was able to record and develop on out and permanently kind of record. And then the in-between space, which is partly the physical objects she has layered on with digital information that you can view through an interactive device. So that's where I'd like it to continue to go.
Well, I'm excited to see where this takes you and to think it all just started talking about pH data and look at all the products that came out of that. It's fantastic. Thank you so much, both David and Leslie, for taking some time to call in all the way from the University of South Florida and talk with us about their art experience at sea. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we are turning our attention to something warm and fuzzy.
Good news from Dynavite. New Nomo Flea Flea and Tick Spray kills fleas and ticks with no poison. New Nomo Flea is totally safe for dogs, cats, puppies, kittens, kids, babies crawling on the carpet, and even you. Because it's made from vegetable oil. Nomo Flea dissolves the hard shell of a flea or tick on contact, so the moist insides of that flea or tick just dry up.
No fleas.
No more flea instantly. No more ticks soon thereafter. Best of all, no more poison, ever. So as of today, you can stop using imidacloprid, moxidectin, pyrethrin, and all those other flea and tick poisons. Get all the grisly nitty-gritty about fleas and ticks, or before your beloved pet ventures out in the backyard again, order a 30 or 60-day supply of new Nomo Flea. Just click the pic of the dead flea on Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
A message from DAV to returning veterans. Thank you for doing your duty and doing our bidding. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way and putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for defending our freedom and displaying your honor. DAV thanks all veterans by fighting to get them the benefits and support they were promised. Visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Joining us now is Michelle Schwengel-Ragala. Michelle is a scientific illustrator and fiber artist, currently working as an artist in residence at the University of Hawaii Manoa Art History Department. Michelle is joining us all the way from Tahiti after coming off a recent Artist at Sea residency aboard research vessel Falkor. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you, Carly. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited to be connecting with you. It's been a while since I've talked to you and heard your voice, but I've been seeing your work all throughout the month, and I have to say it's just been fantastic and exhilarating to see the way that your art is sort of infusing into the science and into the high seas. Tell me a little bit what you've been up to.
Mm-hmm. There have been so many things going on. Let's see. I was on the Falkor starting in Honolulu, and I have to say that was the greatest jumping off point I could have asked for, because Honolulu is where I live and that's where the ship's voyage began. I had the full experience of leaving my home and leaving it behind and getting a sense of what it really is to be so isolated out in the deep blue sea. Once on board, I was welcomed by the science crew and the ship's crew, and the structure of this ship was run so well. Everything was supported, so I had a fantastic time to focus on my work and get right down to business of my tasks at hand.
Excellent. And now you were joining the ship as a fiber artist. Now tell me, what does a fiber artist do, or what does that entail?
As you mentioned at the beginning, I haven't always been a fiber artist. I began my art career as a science illustrator. That was something that developed during college. I just happened to have drawings that caught the eye of one of my professors, and then he had me starting as an illustrator in his laboratory, illustrating his taxonomic research. And from there, I was working with lots of different scientists through my career as an illustrator, and I think that ability to collaborate was something that helped me on board this ship. As a fiber artist, I have created a number of different projects. Some of them are solo works I've done, and others are group projects where I've invited other people to work in fiber and interpret science in the way that I like to do so much. And in this case, I look to the supplies I had on hand. I have a yarn stash that is probably more yarn than I could ever knit up in my lifetime, but I chose select pieces that would come with me and that I hoped would be useful during this experience. It turns out that my materials were well selected for this purpose, for this experience, and I was able to use some of each of the things I brought to make different projects on board.
Yeah, and I want to expand on that, because you brought, you know, going through your suitcase of brightly colored yarns before you left, it was such a neat experience in the way that you enthusiastically talked about each yarn, like there was a story behind it, and what you thought maybe you would use it for was really, really interesting. Can you tell me about some of the locally sourced yarn that you got here in Hawaii?
Oh, absolutely. I'm happy to share this story. Prior to this search for materials, I wasn't really sure if there were any sheep ranches within the state. It's something I wouldn't expect given our climate, but it turns out on the Big Island, Hawaii Island, there are a few different ranches, and I was able to procure some yarn from a woman who runs Maluhia Farms. She has Romney breeds of sheep, and she raises the sheep and shears the sheep, and then the wool is processed a little bit on her ranch, but it can't be completely processed into marketable yarn until it goes to a formal mill. And in this case, she sends it to a mill in California. And I was happy to learn that it was in California rather than somewhere on the East Coast, where most of the woolen mills are in the United States. And in this case, in California, it meant that this product had a much lower a carbon footprint than something that had traveled thousands more miles to come back to Hawaii to be a marketable product. So I was able to get some of her wool overnighted to my island of Oahu. And in that case, I also lowered my risk of maybe not being able to source all the materials that I needed before I was able to get on board. So these wool skeins of yarn were a range of natural colors. That was something that was important to me. I didn't want to have them dyed any other colors. I wanted to work with the natural colors of the yarn. In this case, I had a gradient of cream color to light brown, darker brown, and then the darkest brown, almost black, was from the youngest sheep. I even had a postcard of some of the sheep from which these fleeces were shorn, and it came along with me on the trip.
And so tell us a little bit about what you did with this yarn. I mean, you came up with all kinds of fantastical things that I never would have expected.
Yep, I was expecting the wool to be the foundation for my science-related project, and I also brought along some acrylic yarns that I knew were durable and very color-fast for a different type of project. I also brought some wire and some silk threads that were indigo dyed. And of course, the indigo color was something I connected to the color of the ocean. And so I'd say that my main project working with the scientists was a ground of the cream-colored wool infused with a gradient of these blue silk threads. And then on top of that, I applied some surface designs that reflected the primation that was coming in from the sensors as the scientists were deploying their equipment. So it was like I was doing a sort of shorthand about what the ocean had to say about the specific locations we sat at for our samples.
I love that. And we just talked to Leslie and David, and they were talking about how the pH sensors influenced their art. And it's really nice to hear, again, a different, you know, type of sensor, the CTD or ocean measurements that were influencing your art. Now, besides the CTD sensors, what other types of influence were you receiving into the yarn or into the weaving that you were doing?
Mm-hmm. I come from a scientific perspective that's typically on a much larger scale than what these scientists were working with. One of the scientists on board was a microbiologist, and in some ways I could relate to him the most. He was doing some independent sampling with very simple equipment, a type of net that would be cast over the side to do a plankton tow, and all of the there would be gallons of water that would be filtered through this net, and there's a sieve on the end to let the water pass through, but some of the creatures and materials stay in that net. So we looked at those samples under the microscope, and I was feeling very familiar with that kind of approach to science. So I'm glad I had a little bit of that to look at, as well as some of these other things that the other scientists were looking at, more on the chemical scale and the microbial scale. And that was quite foreign to me. So in this regard, that's something that has really deepened my understanding of science and the way science can be approached from so many different perspectives. And I feel like my art is a way that I can share that new knowledge with other people.
And did you take away anything new from the science party? I mean, did you learn anything about the science that they were doing?
Oh, gosh, so much. When I was looking at the mission description for this voyage and all this talk about the low oxygen levels of certain sections of the ocean, that was quite foreign to me. So I knew that I was going to be diving pretty deep into some new territory. These scientists are microbiologists and biogeochemists. I don't even think I'd heard the word biogeochemistry before this trip, but now I feel like it has been a great way to synthesize so many aspects of science that were my building blocks in my college degree. I studied science, but I didn't go into that physical or chemical realm so much as these folks have. So I've learned about that, the proteome, a concept of a microbial protein language. You know, that's very new to me, and I still have more homework to do once I get back home to get up to speed even further on these ideas. And with that, I'll be able to do even more work with what I've experienced out here.
Excellent. And now I know you've done a lot of work on the ship with this dazzle camouflage concept. And you've really just wowed me with this with this concept and how you've applied it to your work. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure thing. Dazzle camouflage is a type of painting technique. And it was applied by Norman Wilkinson, a British artist who was also, I believe, an officer, a member of the British Navy back in the 20th century, late 19th century, in fact. And
oh, I think we lost you there for a second, Michelle. The dazzle camouflage made you disappear. Well, while we wait to get you back here to connect with us, I'll just add in, too, that with the dazzle camouflage that you had on board, it was really interesting to see how you worked that into the yarn. And so seeing these different multicolored pattern yarn wrappings around the ship in different places. So you would see these blue and green woven poles or red and yellow weaves around the CTD rosette that were going into the water, and sometimes in unexpected places. So it was really interesting to look at the images that were coming off the ship and where all these like hidden little knit yarn items were. We had an eyeball on the watch station on the bridge, and a little homage to Hawaii too. We had spam musubi knits on different places. So that was really unique to see.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now, Michelle. So sorry about the connection cut out there. I guess calling all the way from Tahiti, sometimes that happens. But I was able to fill in the blank there by describing some of the amazing knits we had as part of the dazzle camouflage. But I'd love to hear a little bit more depth about the dazzle camouflage. We got to the point where you shared who invented dazzle camouflage.
Okay, sure. It was applied to Navy ships because at that time, technology between enemies was so primitive that it was quite difficult to see each other at distances. In this case, the crazy painting style of a ship would serve to very much obscure the shape of the ship, the level of gunnery on the ship, and perhaps the direction it was headed. So that was a way to remain more stealth in a wartime situation. Now, this dazzle camouflage fell out of favor when technology and sensing got high enough that, you know, high-powered binoculars and other radar and sonar systems were able to figure out locations a little better. So this technique wasn't used very far into World War II. But nowadays, some car companies, when they're making prototype vehicles that they have to transport from one place to another and they don't want people to necessarily know all the forms and features, they might still use dazzle camouflage. So I like that it's still around in some ways. Now, I decided to use it on the ship. I mean, how many times am I going to get an opportunity to be on a ship and have access to it for this amount of time? I was thrilled. And so there's a graffiti tradition where people are, instead of using paint to put up street art, instead they use knitted textiles or crocheted textiles to make fabric panels that are then put up on a wall or on a structure somewhere on the street. And, well, I took graffiti to the ship, and my chosen technique was to make these dazzle camouflage patterns. Now, some of the patterns that I created were just random stripes of bold, contrasting colors, but I also used some coded languages in some of the panels. I'm a fan of binary code, that language using ones and zeros to represent numbers and letters, and in this case, I translated those ones and zeros into two-color stripe patterns. And using that technique, I sometimes spelled out words in some of my panels. A few of my pieces spelled out the word Falcor, the name of the ship, and another piece spelled out the words Neptune's Trident. And you can probably guess where that one went. There was a trident that was prominently displayed on the ship's monkey deck, and so I very stealthily put that up one night. And then it was part of the very secret equatorial ceremonial crossing that we otherwise cannot talk about.
Of course. Well, I'm really happy you got to experience that and really work in all these unique aspects into the fiber arts that you were doing. Now, is there something in particular that you like about using the yarn or fabric as opposed to illustration or even your experiences as a scientist? What drew you to using yarn as your primary medium?
Mm-hmm. Some years ago, I learned how to knit. You know, the technique was something I'd seen other members of my family doing. I even learned that my great uncles used to knit their own socks back in the day. But when I became a parent, I thought about what kind of artistic medium I could use to express my creativity while I had a little one around. And it turns out this knitting and crocheting was a perfect match. And I learned about a program called the Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef. And this is an exhibit concept that uses mathematical modeling and the hyperbolic forms found in science and nature to be the sort of pattern for people to create structures out of crochet that look like coral. And this was an exhibit idea that I brought to Hawaii in 2010. And that was my first venture into using fiber art as a theme for a community art exhibit. And in this case, I had people from around the world contributing pieces to this exhibit that was focusing on Hawaiian marine life. And from there, I've worked on other fiber projects. The most recent project I worked was an exhibit about the Hadal Zone, and that's the deepest trench community in the ocean. There are specific creatures that live in that area, and that area only. And I had learned only a little bit about these creatures before I endeavored to do this installation. And it turns out people from the University of Hawaii Marine Sciences Department had been on the Falkor and had sampled some of these creatures that were my inspiration for this installation. And so by my chance to be on the Falkor, I feel like I've brought that project full circle in seeing how they did the science, how their sampling techniques were carried out aboard the Falkor. And so fiber to me is a medium that allows people to maybe approach art with a little more comfort. You know, the wool or the various fibers can be soft and fuzzy and familiar. And I think that by working with these fibers, I have the chance to have people consider what my message is through the art in a way that they might not consider if the same things were made of metal or made of oil paint, you know, in an art medium that is typically more formal and maybe, you know, viewed as less of a craft and more of a fine art. But I'm not going to get into that debate right now.
Well, I also love, too, that you've traversed the entire ocean in your art form, from deep Hadal regions to coral reefs to some of the surface seas that you are exploring and beneath on this cruise. So it's really amazing to see how it all has worked into your art. And now I know you were very devoted to the art and knitting away for most of the cruise, but there was also a bit of an outreach component to the program. Tell us a little bit about how you connected to the community from being out at sea and sharing your art with that group.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I really enjoyed that aspect of the Artist at Sea program. When I learned of my acceptance for this program, I sent out messages via different social networks to connect with teachers who had school groups of the ages that would be able to grasp what we were doing out here at sea. So I worked with fifth graders, high school students. We had a ship-to-shore connection for usually a 40-minute interview with schools in Hawaii, in Washington State, in Massachusetts. I loved being able to directly see students and to share with them the experience I was having on the trip and to show them some of the works that I had in progress. I hope it showed these students that mixing disciplines like this, art and science, is entirely possible. And if they felt conflicted like I did when I was in school, do I choose art? Do I choose science? That maybe I've shown them that they don't necessarily have to choose one over the other. I think that there are many ways in which people can mix disciplines very successfully.
And I know you had a son at home. How did he feel about you being out at sea and being able to see you out there?
He was in view during that interview that we had with his first grade class in Hawaii. I was so happy to see his face and the faces of his classmates. I have the feeling that I'll go back to his classroom and share with them even more directly some of the projects that I worked on out there and show some more pictures so they can get a better grasp of it.
I love that.
I also like that another classmate's parent was on the Hokulea for one of those components of the worldwide Polynesian voyage. And I think that these will be nice parallels to each other to both bring different perspectives about what it is to travel through Polynesia, over the ocean, over distances, with different means of sensing the world. And those two ways of sailing are quite different, but I feel like I have a better idea of what the ancient voyagers had going on in their experience and what the modern-day voyagers are experiencing right now.
Well, I love that you've brought it all full circle. Michelle, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us today and for sharing your fantastic work. Anyone who's interested in seeing some of the dazzle camouflage that you've done can look either on the Schmidt Ocean Institute website or, Michelle, what's your Instagram account?
Oh, the secret's out. It is Spam Nitsubi.
Spam Nitsubi. All right. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. Hang tight. We'll be right back and we'll be learning more about art at sea.
Do shopping online and using public Wi-Fi make you vulnerable to identity theft? Does giving out your social security number put you at risk? Is your dog at risk of identity theft? Yes, yes, and no. Your dog has absolutely nothing to worry about. But we do live in a world that can expose a lot of personal information, and that can lead to having your identity stolen and losing everything you've worked for. That's why at LifeLock, we use proprietary technology to detect a wide variety of threats. And unlike free credit monitoring services, we have a dedicated U.S.-based staff to help restore your identity if it ever is compromised. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But if you ask yourself whether you're worth protecting with the best, isn't the answer a resounding yes? Plans start at $9.99 a month, and now you can get 10% off. Go to LifeLock.com and use promo code NEWS.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Last but certainly not least, we have Rebecca Rutstein with us here today. Rebecca is an artist inspired by geology, mapping the undercurrents that shape our world. Most recently, she sailed aboard the Nautilus vessel from Galapagos Islands to California as an artist at sea. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're so happy to have you, and I'm really excited to talk a little bit about your art and your project and why you keep going out to sea. So first, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure. I am an abstract artist. I was originally trained as a painter, and for the past 15 years, I've been working on large-scale oil and acrylic paintings, as you mentioned, inspired by geology and mappings. Over the last 3 years, my work has evolved to include sculpture and installation. I've been working with laser-cut steel forms that are inspired by forms from my own paintings, and I bend the metal and with a blowtorch and to make it undulate the way they often do in my paintings.
Oh, amazing. And what? Where are you drawing your inspiration from these maps and from the paintings? You know, where do you go to think about your work?
You know, as I mentioned, I've been inspired by geology, looking at maps. My work is very process-driven. I work intuitively with color and composition and try to take in my environment and let that flow into the work. So, for instance, on the Nautilus, I was responding to the movement of the ship by pouring paint on the canvas and letting the rocking motion of the ship sort of guide the flow of the paint.
Oh, that's a really interesting technique. I love that.
Yeah, no, it was totally unexpected. That was sort of the exciting part of it. I had brought materials with me and was trying to navigate the challenge of painting on a very rocky ship. We were tracking a hurricane, Hurricane Dolores, in the East Pacific, and I was trying to control the paint and decided instead of fighting the current, I would just sort of kind of roll with it. So that was sort of, that was exciting. Actually, it's funny because, you know, you're talking about where I draw my inspiration. I originally took a geology class when I was an undergraduate. That was in the early 90s. And I was a fine art major, but I took this geology class and it just really blew me away. I kind of stowed that away, and at a later date, it kind of came forward as something that was just really meaningful to me. So I then started using it and incorporating that into my paintings. And, you know, basically what started to happen was I started thinking about the sort of undercurrents and these forces as a metaphor for kind of interpersonal relationships and the ebbs and flows of relationships. And so that's been sort of like this undercurrent in my paintings. I sort of use that as a starting point in all of my work. And then, you know, sort of tailor the projects based on site-specific experiences. So I've done residencies in places like Iceland and on the Big Island of Hawaii, as well as the Canadian Rockies. And in each of those experiences, I sort of learn about the geologic significance of that region and then sort of create a body of work related to that.
Interesting. And is there any particular draw to the ocean for you? I mean, how does the ocean play into your work?
Sure. You know, I am drawn to the ocean because of the kind of the sheer unknown of it. You know, we know more about the surface of the moon and Mars than we do our own oceans. And we've only mapped out about 5 to 10% of the ocean floor, you know, in high resolution. So to be part of this kind of exploration where we can gain a better understanding of our own world and the natural resources that exist and the actual topography of the ocean floor and the potentials and hazards of geologic activity that could impact us, that's like really rewarding to me. I think I initially was inspired to be drawn to the ocean through an article I read about Maurice Scharf, who was an under-recognized oceanographer in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, who used two-dimensional profile sonar readings to create maps, a full entire map of all of the world's oceans, the ocean floor. And she, through her research and through her drawings, discovered the Mid-Atlantic Rift Zone and sort of evidence for plate tectonics. And her theories, she was working at Columbia at the time, her theories were initially debunked by others, but then eventually, you know, it came out that she was correct and that, you know, plate tectonics became the accepted theory. That was sort of an inspiration to me. I went down to the Library of Congress to see a bunch of her drawings and maps. This was around 2006, and I had just had my first son, and I was no longer sort of able to travel to do a lot of these residencies that I had done in the past. And so I was sort of homebound and started thinking about the ocean and sort of imagining this whole mysterious world, and began doing several projects related to the ocean and ocean floor topography and maps.
Excellent. And now you're heading out again for a residency aboard Falkor on the Artist at Sea program. Tell us what a little bit about how you expect the science to influence the art you'll be doing on this next project.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to be going on board. So this particular cruise is going to focus on exploring uncharted and geographically isolated hydrothermal vents off the coast of Tahiti in the South Pacific. And the science team led by Chris German from Woods Hole is going to be using multi-beam sonar to uncover detailed maps and images of the seafloor. And we're going to be searching for new hydrothermal vents and hopefully find new sites and explore the unusual ecosystems that thrive there off of chemosynthesis. So what I'm hoping to do during the expedition is to create multi-layered paintings that incorporate the multi-beam data that we'll be collecting. We'll hopefully be taking this data and rendering it in a 3D visualization software called FlavorMouse, and then I will be moving through the data in FlavorMouse to discover kind of compelling vantage points and compositions that I will then take and fuse into my paintings. And I'll be working on small canvases in the wet lab of the ship. Hopefully, if we do find certain new hydrothermal vents, we will then deploy the AUVs and ROVs to get more detailed imagery and hopefully video of these sites. One of the other really neat things that is going to be happening on the expedition is the science team from Woods Hole is examining fluid flow from these hydrothermal vents and how they are carried out into the larger ocean basins through the current. And they are interested in collaborating with me to sort of create visualizations of that data that they're collecting. So these fluid flows are associated with the hotspot volcanism of this particular area. And so I'm really looking forward to collaborating with them on this, and we're hopeful to join together to submit a paper to the National Science Foundation at some point.
Well, that would be fantastic. And how do you see art and science intersecting together? You know, how does this come together for you?
Sure, it's a great question. You know, when I was aboard the Nautilus, Robert Ballard made an insightful analogy about how exploring the deep ocean is like standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon in the dark, and that the artist can turn the light on. And so I see art sort of making the invisible visible and communicating scientific ideas in a visceral way that can reach a larger audience. You know, I think that artists and scientists share a common desire to make sense of the world around them, but they do so from different perspectives. And those differences are what make the kind of cross-disciplinary exchange exciting. So I think that, you know, having an artist embedded with a scientist on the ship is going to be a powerful collaboration, because, you know, an artist has the capacity for wonder and questioning in their work. You know, communication is inherent in art, and, you know, an artist has an affinity for creativity and innovation, and I think that those qualities can benefit researchers who invite them to collaborate. So, and, you know, of course, science and technology has a huge impact on artists and society as a whole. So I just I think that there's a lot of exciting outcomes that can happen through this collaboration, and I'm just thrilled to be, you know, part of it for one of these expeditions.
Well, we're looking forward to having you on board, Rebecca, and to see the type of work that you're going to do and all the outcomes. We're running short of time here. Real quickly, where can we go see your work if we wanted to take a look?
Sure. You can go to my website, which is just RebeccaRutstein.com. That would be a good place to start.
All right. Well, let's start with there. Thank you so much for your time, Rebecca. I look forward to hearing about the amazing work that's coming out of this project and to see what happens in the future. I'd like to thank all my guests today for sharing the experience of art and science and talking to me about their experiences. I'd also like to give a special thank you to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.